Well, yeah, thanks so much, and thanks to the organizers, Philippe, in particular, for inviting me out. Many of you probably don't know that my current boss, Andrew Murray, did a sabbatical with Philippe, and he told us frequently about how wonderful the food was in Paris, and how great the wine was, and how he took long lunches every day. So it's exciting to come here today and see that you guys are actually doing some science in addition to eating. But I'm going to tell you about the work that we've really been quite interested in over the last few years during my time as a Bauer Fellow at Harvard, and I'm going to be leaving in a couple months to start a faculty position. Okay, so I won't introduce the microbiome. I think that's been covered already, but I wanted to start by pointing out that one of the important metabolic activities that really has gone undiscussed today that these microbes have is the ability to transform many of the small molecules that we ingest. And these can be components of the diet that may be important for our health, including small molecules, but also the standard components like carbohydrates and protein. But it also includes a diverse array of compounds that are normally found in the body, as well as xenobiotics, foreign compounds like drugs or antibiotics. And so this idea has been appreciated for some time, and there's been 44 different drugs that have been shown to be directly metabolized, and a few that have been shown to be influenced by indirect interactions. So I want to just summarize the various ways that microbes in the gut can influence xenobiotics. There are examples in the literature of drugs that are actually turned on by gut microbes, so their activity entirely depends on gut activity. And in addition to that, I'll tell you about one particular drug that we've been studying that's actually inactivated by a particular species in the gut microbiota. And so this is an example of microbes stealing your hard-fought drugs. And in addition to that, many drugs owe some of their side effects to toxic byproducts that are produced during the process of microbial metabolism. And then finally, I'm sure everyone's aware that many of the compounds we ingest have antimicrobial properties, and this influences not just pathogens, but the normal resident members of our gut microbiota. In addition to that, there's some interesting studies in the literature, some of which from Elaine and members of the Nicholson group, that show, as well as Sven, that show that microbial colonization can actually influence the way our own body deals with xenobiotics. And so that can come in the form of microbial signals that change the expression of key genes in the liver and the intestine, but also microbial metabolites that can go into general circulation and interfere with the activity of our own enzymes. Okay. So I want to just briefly point out that even though there's dozens of examples of drugs that are on the market that are directly metabolized, we know essentially nothing about the microbiology underlying these reactions. And so this is just a list of these 44 that we reviewed a couple years ago. And if you were to go down this list, we know precisely what the reaction is. We know what the substrate is and the products. But for only two of these 44 examples, they've ever been linked to a particular enzyme in the gut microbiome. In addition to that, only five of these 44 have ever even been linked to a specific bug. And so the rest, we only know that the community as a whole performs this metabolism. We don't know anything about the particular members that are responsible. And then finally, we don't know sort of how broadly this affects the drugs that we're taking. So of the 4,000 or 5,000 FDA-approved compounds, how many are being influenced by the microbiome? Okay. In addition to that, I think I want to just point out that, many of the factors that have been studied in the context of host xenobiota metabolism have really only just been recently started to be explored in context to microbial xenobiotic metabolism. And so traditionally, pharmacologists will think about things like transit time, absorption, enterohepatic circulation, variations in host genotype, and so forth, that provide ways to regulate the amount of drug and the fate of these medications in our body. And in addition to that, we can sort of think about microbe-specific factors that might be important. So one thing that I think came up earlier and will be discussed throughout the talk is that it's important to consider the differences between specific strains of bacteria that are in each of our guts, and also the way in which these microbes communicate with each other and ultimately shaping their metabolic activity. Okay, so today I'm just going to focus on digoxin. It's a drug that we became very interested in a few years ago because it's really one of the few examples where we have a metabolic activity, really of any kind, that's been linked to just a single bacterial species in the gut. So it's sort of a natural example of something that could be studied in a reductionist way. So digoxin is a natural compound that was isolated hundreds of years ago from this deadly but beautiful plant. And despite the fact that it's so old, it's still used around the world today. And so it's used for heart failure as well as irregular heartbeat and in patients of a variety of different ages, including adults, the elderly, and even pregnant women. And the mechanism of action involves the inhibition of a cardiac sodium potassium ATPase, slowing heart rate and increasing the force and velocity of the patient's contractions. So what's challenging about this drug, I'm told from clinicians, is that it's one of the most toxic medications that we have out there. And the therapeutic range, which is the difference between the amount of drug that needs to make it into circulation for its efficacy and the amount that induces toxicity, is incredibly small. And so it's thought to be 0.5 to 2 nanograms per mil in the serum of humans to allow for the utility of the drug. If you sort of go over 2 nanograms per mil, you induce a variety of different side effects, and this has been really well studied, involving a variety of different gastrointestinal side effects, cardiac dysfunction, and then a curious side effect, which is that the use of digoxin induces xanthopsia, which is this very blurry, yellowy vision. And so I always like to sort of put myself in the mindset of the patient, and so this I like to start with this picture. And this will hopefully give you a sense for what it's like if you're overdosing on digoxin. And it's also sort of curiously was reported back in 1981 that there's evidence that Van Gogh actually literally might have been overdosing on digoxin. The reason they think that is for a variety of different reasons. Van Gogh was an epileptic, and so he was being treated with foxgloves at the time. He also transitioned from painting everything in brown to yellow. And then finally, to sort of cap it off, every time he drew his doctor at the end of his life, he pictured him with a foxglove. All right. So why were we interested in digoxin as microbiologists? There's a really nice set of studies by John Lindenbaum's group at Columbia back in the 80s. And what they showed is that the microbiota performs a very simple reaction, a reduction, that converts digoxin to dihydrodigoxin. And this downstream product is completely inactive. So it's a microbial metabolite that cannot bind to its target receptor. And then they went on to do a variety of different human studies, and one of the things they noted was that if you administer broad-spectrum antibiotics at the same time as digoxin, you elevate the amount of drug that makes it into circulation. In addition to that, they went even farther to screen hundreds of different isolates from the gut, and they showed that there's just a single bacterial species that in vitro could perform the reaction. It's called Agarthella lenta. This is a bug that you probably haven't heard that much about yet, but it's a common actinobacterium that we think is widely distributed, possibly in all of our guts, and shown here by SEM. And again, this is an example that we thought was very compelling because it's just a single organism that we know performs the reaction, but we don't have any idea how exactly this reaction plays out. Okay, so there's just one problem with all of this. It was noted back in the 80s that despite the fact that E. lenta is the only bug that performs this reaction, neither the presence of these bacteria nor their concentration in the gut has anything to do with digoxin reduction. And so that's kind of a bummer if you're trying to develop a diagnostic assay. And so what do we think is going on? Roland hypothesized back in the 80s that maybe Lindenbaum was just really bad at culturing. And you know, we certainly know that there's many challenges in accurately representing the concentration of a bug based on a petri dish. But alternatively, I think we can propose today that maybe there's other factors that really shape Ulenta's metabolic activity in the gut. And so I'm going to tell you about three of these that we have some initial evidence for. One is variation within the species Ulenta. One is microbial interactions, and then also the importance of considering diet in shaping microbial activity. Okay. So the first thing to keep in mind for Ulenta is that it's picked a very strange niche. Unlike most of the dominant bacteria in the gut, it doesn't eat sugar. Instead, it gets carbon, nitrogen, and energy just from the amino acid arginine. And the reason it can do this is it has this straightforward, relatively short pathway that allows it to import arginine and convert it to ATP. And so if you grow the bug in the lab and increase the concentration of arginine, you can increase the amount of total growth of Ulenta. The same is true for citrulline, the downstream product in this pathway, but not for ornithine, the side product. But it gets a little bit more interesting if you measure Ulenta's inactivation of digoxin at the same time. So in the solid line, you can see again the relationship between growth and arginine. But in the dotted line, we've quantified the amount of digoxin that we added to the culture that was converted to the inactive downstream product, dihydrodigoxin. And so at low levels of arginine, we can see this reaction occurs, but at high levels, it seems to be blocked. And so we wanted to use this observation to try to use RNA sequencing to look for genes in the genome of Ulenta that were expressed at high levels when we add the drug, relative to no drug controls, and also expressed at higher levels under low arginine condition. And that would be consistent with this pattern of metabolism. And so we found one particular operon that showed a really striking pattern of gene expression. If you haven't seen this sort of data before, we're just sort of marching along the Ulenta genome, and we've aligned all the RNA sequencing reads. And so everywhere you see a peak, it's proportional to the level of gene expression at that base. These are all the replicates in exponential phase in the absence of digoxin and in both low and high arginine, and you can see this region of the genome is essentially off, whereas when we add digoxin, it turns on quite strong, over 100-fold upregulation. And this got us very excited because the two genes encoded by this operon are both predicted bacterial cytochromes, and so that fits with the our biochemical intuition of the types of enzymes that might be able to accept digoxin as an alternative electron acceptor. And so I'm going to refer to this operon as the cardiac glycoside reductase operon, or CGR, for the rest of the talk. Okay. The other thing that was exciting in the RNA-seq data and confirmed by QRT-PCR is that arginine regulates the expression of this operon. And so again, if we look in the absence of digoxin, there's really low expression of CGR2, one of the two genes here. Whereas when we add the drug, they come on strong, and they're expressed at significantly higher levels in exponential phase in low arginine relative to high arginine, and the same is true in stationary phase. Okay. So one of the challenges that we face is that despite the fact that people were interested in Ulenta for many years back in the 70s, nobody has actually taken the time to try to do any genetics on this organism. And on top of that, we unfortunately identified two membrane-associated cytochromes which come from a gram-positive actinobacterium, which are notoriously hard to clone into E. coli. So we don't really have a great way to definitively prove that these genes are responsible. And so we've been taking, similar to other talks today, a sort of natural history approach where we just collect a lot of naturally occurring strains of Ulenta and try to line up their activity to their gene content. And so I'm just going to show you data for the first three strains that we looked at that are published, but we've expanded this collection to 15 now, and it seems like the trends are holding up so far. Okay, so originally we had the type strain, which again reduces digoxin, and then two non-reducing strains. We've never been able to detect any dihydrodigoxin. And we compared their three genomes and found that, just as we expected, the CGR operon was unique to the type strain. So that gave us a little bit more confidence that we've identified the genes responsible, and we wanted to see if we could actually use that to predict the rate of digoxin metabolism in the setting of a complex microbial community. And so we recruited 20 unrelated people And then we proceeded with this ex vivo assay. So basically, the assay involves taking fecal samples from each of the 20 people, incubating them in the lab in the presence of the drug, and then just measuring how much is converted to dihydrodigoxin. And we found that we could group these 20 people between low reducers that leave most of the drug intact, and high reducers, most of whom reduced all of the drug that we exposed them to. And just as you expect, if we use qPCR to quantify the abundance of the CGR genes in the overall microbiome, we find that the high reducers have significantly higher gene levels. And you'll probably note there's a couple outliers, but overall, if you sort of calculate precision, sensitivity, and specificity for this pretty simple diagnostic, it does pretty well. Okay. In addition to that, we found some sort of surprising results that hint at a potential for microbial interactions to change Elenta's activity. And this came from experiments where we were starting with these low-reducing communities and then spiking in different strains of Elenta. So it's very similar to the last assay, where we just have the type strain or one of these non-reducing strains growing in the presence of the drug. And just as you would expect, we can detect dihydro just by the type strain. But then we take these low-reducing microbial communities and then spike in these two different strains of Elenta. And as you would expect, when we put in the type strain, we see that we can detect the metabolism of digoxin. But surprisingly, we actually saw significantly higher levels in the context of a community than what we would see if the type strain were just growing alone. And in addition to that, we were able to show that the CGR ratio is elevated, as you would expect, and that there are significantly higher levels of Elenta at the end of the incubation. And so this sort of suggests that some other member of the community may be sort of promoting Elenta's activity. One way that we know, or really the only growth factor that we know about for Elenta is arginine, and I told you before that that actually blocks reduction, so we wanted to confirm that in these interacting situations, we could still suppress Elenta's metabolism using arginine, and that was the case. So this is, again, just a gut microbiota adding in the type strain that, again, shows high levels of reduction, and if we spike in arginine, we can still suppress it. So this suggests that it's not necessarily arginine that's a growth factor for Elenta, but other products that are being produced by the other members of the gut microbiota might stimulate Elenta's growth in a way that doesn't block its metabolism of the drug. Okay. So finally, we wanted to return to this observation that arginine can suppress drug metabolism in vitro and ask the question of whether or not, based on this understanding of Elenta's biology, we could actually rationally manipulate microbial drug metabolism based on just changing diet. And so in particular, we thought, you know, maybe we could just change the levels of total protein and that would allow us to manipulate Elenta. And so to do this experiment, we turned to the system that we've heard about quite a bit today. We use notobiotic isolators where we can maintain mice sterile and then colonize them all with the type strain of Elenta. And then we just did a simple experiment where halfway through, so a week after colonization, we split the mice onto two paired diets. So these diets all have the same ingredients, but one we've just dropped out the protein, and then the other has 20% protein. And we were excited to see that on the high protein diet, the levels of digoxin in the serum were significantly elevated, and the same was true for the urine. And so this suggests that this high level of dietary protein may elevate the concentration of arginine in the gut, which we confirmed by mass spec, and that this increased level of arginine may block Elenta's metabolism. But obviously, there could be direct effects of these two different diets on the host, which could have implications for the fate of this drug in the body. And so we wanted to try to control for that. And so we colonized mice again with the type strain, but also a separate set of mice with one of these control strains of Elenta that's not capable of metabolizing the drug. And then just put half of the mice on the 0% protein diet and half on 20%. And again, in mice colonized with the type strain, we saw a significant difference in serum as well as urine digoxin levels, but we didn't see any significant differences in mice colonized with the non-reducing strain. Okay. And so I'll show a little bit of new data. This is a preliminary experiment where we wanted to sort of deal with the fact that in our previous experiments, we've been doing a relatively radical diet shift. And so, you know, no protein is obviously not ideal for a mouse or a human. And so we wanted to keep the total protein level constant, but just change the specific amino acid arginine. And so we designed two diets that instead of having protein, actually have a mixture of defined amino acids. And you can see them here. So all of the amino acids are at essentially the same concentration except for arginine, which is at zero in one of in the 0% arginine diet. And the amount of arginine is in the 1.2% diet is the same amount that we would expect to see from casein, which was in the original two diets. And so in early experiments, we've been able to show that if even by just manipulating arginine, we can recapitulate the change in digoxin levels in the serum, although unfortunately we didn't see a difference in the urine. But that's much more to be done. So our sort of working model for how this is happening is that you can imagine people that are primarily colonized with these non-reducing strains of Elenta, and their microbial communities will leave this drug intact. Alternatively, if you're colonized with strains like the type strain, they're capable of performing this activity, but that reaction occurs in the context of the concentration of arginine. And we think that, you know, that arginine could obviously come from protein based on experiments, but possibly also from the host or other microbes. And in addition to that, there's some early data suggesting that other members of the gut microbiota may be talking to Elenta in a way that actually increases the rate of this reaction. But again, that can be suppressed by arginine. And so to sort of summarize, we think it's, again, important to consider very subtle sort of strain level variations in the microbiome, diet, as well as the way in which these microbes are interacting. Okay, so hopefully I've convinced you that we've made a little bit of progress in understanding digoxin, but we have a long way to go, I think, before we understand microbial pharmacology in general. So that's one drug. If you were to open up a web browser right now and pull up DrugBank, you'd find that there's around 8,000 drug-like compounds out there. And so I think we have quite a bit of work to figure out the extent of the interaction between drugs and the microbiome. And so there's simple questions and I think very fundamental questions that remain unanswered. We don't understand how many other drugs are being directly or indirectly influenced. We don't understand very much about the mechanism. So unlike in the host, we are at very early days in even identifying the major enzymes that are involved in the microbiome's metabolism of drugs. We have very little information about the other host microbial or dietary or even other environmental factors that influence this. And, you know, down the line, hopefully you can imagine that if we can, you know, understand these important reactions that are really key for the outcome of different treatments, we might be able to design personalized medicine approaches where we can actually tailor a treatment to a given microbiome. Okay. And then I also want to point out that, as I mentioned at the beginning, my fellowship at Harvard is over, and so I'm moving to San Francisco starting in September. So if anyone would be willing to leave Paris and come to San Francisco, definitely drop me a line. And I just want to thank the Center for Systems Biology. It's been a fantastic and supportive place to be for the last 4 years. My great three postdocs, Corinne, Rachel, and Henry, all of the work I showed today was the work of Henry, who's recently left the lab to take a position at Novartis. And our great collaborators, Emily Balskas, who helped with all the analytical and synthetic chemistry, a lot of which I didn't present today. Lynn Bree, who runs the Notobiotic Mouse Facility, and also the UNC Notobiotic Mouse Facility that provided a lot of the animals. So thanks a lot.